You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 29th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Kara is not joining us this week. She's too busy. Just finishing up her work and whatnot.
Now that she's a doctor and all, you know, it's very busy.
We'll see. We'll see when that's official. We'll let everybody know.
There's a specific. She explained to us. There's a specific point or criteria, a line specifically.
Yeah, we'll let you know when we cross that line. This episode is coming. We're recording a little bit early because we're going to Dragon Con this weekend. This episode will be coming out the week after Dragon Con, so we will have already been there in podcast time.
Oh my gosh, we had a blast, I think.
I'm assuming, yeah.
Right?
Hopefully the hurricane didn't interfere with our trip. Hurricane barreling up the Atlantic Ocean. Right now it's supposed to miss us. We will see. We will have seen by the time this episode comes out.
Yep. I mean, what could it potentially... What's the worst case scenario?
It grounds planes. We can't get out.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, or can't get in.
Can't
either.
Didn't we have something like this happen when we were in Tennessee and we drove back?
A little hurricane called, I think, what was it, Sandy? Yeah. You may have heard of it.
It's like a 10-hour drive home, too.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
And we rode the edge of that storm the whole way home. Remember?
Yeah.
Remember the ominous skies that were chasing us?
We were riders on a storm.
I remember the really cool Halloween store we ran by and went in.
I remember by the time we got home, I was delirious.
Well, it wasn't just the drive, if you remember. It was like the 12 hours before we had to drive when we kind of realized, all right, we have to start putting a plan into action because our flights had been, canceled? I think by that point.
Yep.
So you're effectively stranded, 800, 900 miles from home and with no plan whatsoever. So, having to scramble to get the van and change, and rally it all together. It was really more of like a 24-hour ordeal.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, I know you guys have heard this because we talked about it, but I'm going to play it right now in the episode. Listen to this and tell us what you think this is. So that was Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Yes.
Right? Very recognizable.
On a crummy, broken tape player or something.
Yeah, it sounds a little distorted in a weird way. That is an AI-generated clip based upon, basically the brain activity of somebody listening to the song.
That's pretty amazing.
How?
We talked about this, I think it was a Science or Fiction a couple months ago, that when you add the AI to interpret the brain signals, it really makes a huge leap in its ability to go from brain activity to audio, to what the person is thinking or hearing or trying to say. It really is amazing technology.
And with the clarity of the lyric as well, it's one thing to, sort of get a musical representation just with no lyric, right? You can come close, and I think your brain can have a lot of latitude there to say, yeah, this is pretty close. But then you start hearing a lyric kick in and it's recognizable.
Oh, yeah.
To, sounding of the word. That sort of brings it to another level.
And I was reading a news item today. I was going to use it for science fiction, and I realized it's too close to what we talked about, a couple months ago. Where just another study looking at this technology, AI-assisted interpretation of brain waves to figure out what words somebody's thinking of. And they claimed a 92 to 100% accuracy.
Yeah.
So, and I don't, I'd have to look deeper into exactly. Sometimes there was a limited choice of things that they were choosing from. But even still, this is years ahead of where I thought we would be because of that introduced element of, have AI do the analysis and figure out how to, there's got to be a learning curve. Like a trained AI on going from words to brain activity, brain activity to words. You have to have a feedback loop where it's trained. Then it gets really good at it, at interpreting an individual's brain activity. It does not carry over to another individual.
Right.
You got to be trained on one specific person.
clinical application here?
Oh, yeah. You're locked in. You can't talk. You can't, you know what I mean? You can't communicate. Yeah. Strap that an EEG on your head, hook it up to one of these AIs, train it for a little bit, and then it's, you know, you're communicating.
That's such an incredible thing for people.
Oh, my God.
Who are find themselves in that super unfortunate situation. I mean, that is just beyond a world of difference.
I always think of Pike on Star Trek. It's like, really? 200 years in the future? And they're saying yes, no. Oh, even then, even like when it was, you know, first coming out in the early 70s, late 60s, I thought, really, we're not going to be more advanced than that? We're already way past that.
Yeah, there's like big, big internet arguments going on about how ridiculous that was. And people try to like retcon it and make sense of it. And other people are like, that's just, you know, that's just what they decided to do. You know, it doesn't mean that.
It was kind of important for the narrative because you couldn't have Pike just communicating with them.
Right.
That was giving away the whole storyline.
That basically shaped the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
That happens quite often.
And the Futurama parody of that one, look it up. It's one of the funniest episodes you've ever seen.
You're enjoying the reboot of Futurama, Evan?
Oh, damn, man. I got to start watching.
Steve, shame on me. I have not yet watched.
It's good. I've watched like 5 or 6 episodes. Really good.
I'm so far behind. I got to catch up.
I am at this stage now where I am like fully intimidated by artificial intelligence because. Because
let's talk about that, Jay, since that's my news item. Let's just slide right into
that.
Okay.
We've talked about the latest crop of artificial intelligence, basically the generative pre-trained transformers. You know, transformers is a type of AI technology. Generative means that it's generating content, and pre-trained means that it's already been trained on a lot of data. So, and another way to look to refer to these applications like ChatGPT, again, the GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, is these are large language models. They are modeling language. So they don't, the AI itself doesn't necessarily have to understand anything about the words that it's generating. It's just predicting the next word chunk, right? And remarkably effective at generating natural sounding, real sounding text, poetry, prose, answers to questions.
It's striking, yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty striking.
Basically blowing away the Turing test at this point, right?
Totally. There's been a number of studies looking at how ChatGPT specifically does when given certain standardized tests or how ChatGPT does on academic performance, right? For example, recently, one study showed that ChatGPT was able to pass the medical boards. You know, there you go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
With a just passing score, but still, just passing is passing.
Yeah.
All right, so there's a recent study which I thought was worth, you know, updating this and we could discuss. This is looking at how ChatGPT performs at a university level, right? So now, essentially what they did was they took essay-type test questions in 32 different fields. And they gave students the questions and they gave ChatGPT the questions. Then they had blinded evaluators, people who teach that course.
They didn't know what they were.
You know. Yeah, just grade them, like how'd they do. And, you know, the results were that, you know, ChatGPT did pretty well. So in 9 of the 32 courses, it did as well or better than the students. So
this is ChatGPT 4.0, right?
Yeah, this is the latest ChatGPT.
Wow.
And in most of the rest, it was in the range. It did pretty well. You know, it wasn't quite statistically as good as the students, but it was up there. There was a few courses where it did poorly.
Jim.
Poorly, flat out poorly.
Flat out poorly, like, you know, real significantly less than the students. So one was mathematics. So we already know ChatGPT, not so good at math. The second one was economics because it's very math-based.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one was coding, also because of the math-based component of that. So basically that's just telling us ChatGPT isn't good at math. But other than that, as long as there isn't a huge math component to the course material, it did as well or better than the university students at basically doing a test or homework type.
Wow. Like
essay type assignments. The obvious concern here is that students will be using this to do their assignments, right? And they did a couple other elements of the test. They put the ChatGPT's answers through two standard bits of software whose job is to detect ChatGPT generated answers.
Oh, give me a break. That's not really.
So the two tools, the two ChatGPT detecting tools, failed to detect the AI's work in 32% and 49% of the time. So in one of them, it was a coin flip, right?
It's roll the dice at this point. I mean,
the other one, it was only a third of the time they didn't detect it. So that's obviously not good.
Yeah, this point in time, I think it's pretty. People generally agree that those kind of tools to detect it are just not even good. Don't even use them at this point.
There's a lot of false positives too.
Oh my God,
claiming that a student's work is an AI's work. So yeah.
That's true too. Yeah.
All right. So a little bit of nuance here. So and this is similar to other research because I've been following this type of research pretty closely. And so you could start to ask like what kind of content is ChatGPT good at and what kind is it not so good at? And we could break it down into a few categories. So one is factual knowledge. Another is sort of cognitive analysis. And a third is creativity. So in general, you would probably guess this, ChatGPT does best at factual knowledge.
Sure.
It's just knowing stuff. Like if the test is just, do you know facts? ChatGPT does really well.
Well, is it so much facts as do you know your training data?
Well, that's the same thing.
Yeah, right? It is. Just throwing that out there.
It obviously doesn't understand anything, but it can reproduce the factually correct answers to fact-based questions. Creativity and cognitive analysis, it did not do as well as the students. It did better in the fact-based questions. But this is interesting. If you evaluate the questions based upon the difficulty. As the questions got more difficult, the gap narrowed.
I see.
Meaning that the students
got
harder quicker for the students than it did for ChatGPT. I don't know if that pattern was going to hold up and really be reproducible, but that's interesting to think about that. You would think that, for the really challenging questions, ChatGPT falters. Like, no, actually, the students faltered more than the ChatGPT did. And in fact, it started to become harder to separate them the harder the questions became, the more challenging they were in terms of like abstract thought and creativity.
So, but creativity is a little more subjective, though, right?
Yeah.
So, totally. So harder to measure.
Yeah, but maybe that's an artifact of that. You're right. And the authors do mention that, like the more subjective measures, it's harder to make firm conclusions about. So there's a couple of things we could chat about here. One is, this is a snapshot today. This is going to be different in 6 months, in a year, in 5 years.
6 months, yeah.
5 to 10 years from now,
ooh,
forget about it.
It's unpredictable.
We're going to look back and laugh at this news item.
I would say we shouldn't assume that we're going to keep the same pace of improvement as we've been seeing over the last few years.
No Moore's Law here?
No. And there are some experts who are saying, and I've read their essays where they argue specifically that we're going to plateau. Like we're already getting diminishing returns. And so you have to think, why are they so much better than at doing this kind of task than previous AIs? One is that it's being trained on massive amounts of data.
Yeah.
But there's only so much headroom there. Like there's only so much more data you could train it on. And again, you get diminishing returns. Like once you're training on billions of samples of data, do you really get better if you do another billion?
Right. You would need orders of magnitude more, I would think. And that's not going to happen.
Steve, I was under the assumption that we were going to be moving into expert systems where it's trained very, very specifically, like to be a lawyer or to be able to solve medical issues.
Yeah, so that's a question, is how much room for improvement is there on specialty trained GPTs? And also, how much more room for improvement is there just on fixing things like the hallucinations, where it sort of makes up stuff.
Right.
So you might add some subroutines in there that reduces the errors and the hallucinations. And you could, have specially trained versions of ChatGPT that's not just trained on the internet, but that's trained on all the medical stuff or all legal knowledge, legal textbooks and cases and everything.
I've heard ideas, Steve, about taking those, making many, many of those like little expert systems and then linking them together which sounded intriguing. Who knows if it's a viable path forward, but it does sound intriguing. But yeah, clearly the low-hanging fruit has been picked. But I still think we may be a little bit surprised as to all the different ways we can apply it and use it and tweak it. Like typically, right, it's the classic sci-fi scenario where it's like no one's really seeing how it's going to be used and how it's going to be applied. So we may see some more of that. But yeah, we definitely have gotten all this low-hanging fruit. And who knows, we may need a paradigm change to really have that next leap.
So, but I think we could say, it's safe to say, like according to this and other studies, ChatGPT is up to the task of doing any student's homework, right? I mean, that, at this point, and it's only going to get better. It's already at the point where it's so hard to detect. There's no reliable detection method. Plus, the other thing is, you know, students can easily subvert any detection method by just lightly editing the output of the ChatGPT. You know what I mean?
Right.
They would be kind of silly to just use it completely unaltered. But you could have it do 95% of your work for you and turn a several-hour task into a 10 or 20-minute task. It might take you a few tries to get the good prompt, and then you get the result that you're happy with, and then you sort of lightly edit it so it sounds like your prose. And it's basically undetectable at that point. No one could detect who did the actual work. So what are teachers and professors to do? Right, that's the question.
I think it boils down to the testing, because the kind of testing where you can't use AI to help, and at some point it may come to the point where you have to be in like a specific room where technology won't even function. Like you got some super slick kind of like, you know, inner ear insert and you know, computerized glasses, whatever, you would have to like even try to make sure that wasn't in there, and to just be like, it's all on you. It's just you and a pen and a paper and no technology to help you. That's how they may really assess how much are you actually learning, because homework is going to be worthless in terms of like assessing.
Or oral exam.
Exactly. Same idea.
But isn't that, that presents a whole other range of difficulties, right? Because some people would do much better in a written test rather than an oral test on the same material.
Yeah. Well, write it in the class where, you know, you can't have any help. I mean,
What I suppose you would have is a database where you would log in to do your assignment, and which the school or the institution controls, and it's impervious to being able to be manipulated by the ChatGPT. I mean,
so there's another approach. So first, let me back up a little bit and say that, you know, if you read commentary about this, I've encountered three basic approaches to this problem. One is to say, if kids want to cheat, screw them. They're cheating themselves out of an education.
I don't think that's right.
That doesn't work, I think, because teachers need a way to assess the effectiveness of their own teaching. And if that is taken away from them, they may not realize that what they're doing isn't working. And also grade, sometimes, you know, some classes, some schools grade on a curve. And there's a certain competitiveness, you know, in terms of like going to the next level of your education or whatever. So there has to be a level playing field, and you don't want to punish the students who are not cheating, basically. So that, I don't think that works. The other one is like really aggressive detection methods. I think we agree that's going to fail.
Yep.
That is failing. So we're left with basically methods of evaluating the effectiveness of the teaching and how much the students have learned that are ChatGPT proof. This may require a significant reorganization of the entire process. This may not be a quick fix. So, for example, and I think the good news is I think we're already moving in this direction. I think I've said on the show, like at you know my medical school, we don't lecture anymore. Like we don't give lectures. Students consume the material on their own time via video, podcast, you know, audio, and written material. And then when we have class time, we're doing workshops.
Right.
So I think that's what we need to go to that model where it's like, okay, on Tuesday's class, we're going to be talking about chapter 3. Here's all your material. Here's the chapter. Here's a video about it. Here's, you know, lectures about it, whatever. By Tuesday, you should have consumed all this material. And then when during that classroom time, you're talking about like what do people think about it and analyzing the content or solving problems with the skills that they, you know, were supposed to have learned. And so that not only becomes a superior way of teaching the material, but also a way of evaluating the students. And I think any testing, as Bob said, needs to be live in the classroom, free of technology.
And the student would know that if they are kind of more limited than the other students in their participation, that their grade may suffer as a result of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, this exists. I mean, I had classes where even in college 30 years ago, it was like classroom participation will be part of your grade. That was just baked into some of the classes because they were so – like we did one class on the Canterbury Tales and – like the discussions, you had to have read it. And if you didn't read it, you weren't going to be able to participate in the classroom discussion. And that would have negatively affected your grade. Like that was part of your evaluation. So that just needs to come forward as like the primary way of evaluating students, not like here, write an essay, because that's just useless now as a way of evaluating students. The final thought I'll leave you with is that I think it's pretty clear that this needs to happen or something like this. We need to brainstorm other ways to sort of make ChatGPT proof classwork, but universities and colleges and schools can't just put this on the teachers. They can't just say like do all this additional work to sort of reimagine education. They need support and infrastructure, and this is a disruptive technology. It has successfully disrupted institutions of learning, and there needs to be I think a significant change to how we evaluate students, and that's going to require resources. You can't just dump that on teachers.
Should there be punishment if students are caught cheating?
Well, that's the second approach is like trying to detect and punish cheating. I think because there's so many false positives, false negatives, it's problematic. You end up punishing students who didn't cheat.
Yeah, so it would have to go through a.
I would say no. I don't think that's work. We're not effective enough to do that.
Let's ask ChatGPT. What's the best way to get around this problem?
Yeah.
It has some ideas.
Right. All right, Jay, tell us about geothermal energy.
Well, Steve, you and I are fans of geothermal. We've talked about this in the past. Like it's something we've discussed briefly where you could get a geothermal heating and air conditioner put into your house, right? And this is a similar concept, except on a huge, like an order of magnitude, larger scale or even more. So the fact is the United States, basically, every country is sitting on a significant and largely untapped source of clean, renewable energy, and this is geothermal energy. So this energy source is capable of potentially powering the entire world, since heat energy is everywhere if you drill deep enough. It gets warmer and warmer. That's the key,
drilling deep enough.
Of course.
That's what that costs.
As a renewable energy, it could potentially be a game changer if things go well. Now, compared to wind and solar, geothermal would be consistent. There would always be that heat there that we could use to produce steam, to turn turbines, to produce energy. Wind and solar, as you guys know, it's unpredictable. We have external factors, weather conditions. Is the wind blowing? Yes or no. Is the sun shining? Yes or no. And sometimes it's yes and sometimes it's no. Well, geothermal energy, it's always there. The heat is always there. So this makes it a consistent and reliable source of clean power. Now, historically, it's been difficult to collect geothermal energy efficiently because we've had to find unique geological conditions that are required for traditional geothermal plants to take advantage of it, right? So today's geothermal power plants tap into naturally occurring underground hot water reservoirs and things like that that can drive turbines that generate electricity. But, there's only a certain number of these out there that would work. By putting an energy generator on top of. So only a small fraction of America's electricity is produced through this method, and it's 0.4%. It's not a lot. It's relatively insignificant today how much we're getting from it. Existing drilling and fracking technologies, though, have been steadily getting better. As the years go by, there's been a significant technological boom for drilling and fracking since the early 2000s. And these advancements now make geothermal energy collection feasible. Like we are at that point where the technology has progressed far enough where we have dozens of new energy companies popping up and are all trying to take advantage of this new, these new fracking and drilling machinery and techniques that we have. And they want to get in on the geothermal potential here because it's, you know, it's likely to happen. It's just a matter of time. Now, we have companies out of all the companies, I pick out a couple here, like Fervo Energy. They're using fracking techniques to try and crack open hard rock formations and then create artificial geothermal reservoirs. Basically, you know, they drill deep enough where there's a constant store of heat, and then they inject water into the fractured rock. Then the heat would create steam from the water, and that, you know, and again, that's all you need, right? You need a way to collect that steam energy, and they have different techniques to do that. I can get into a little detail. Like in this instance, they would create, they would drill two holes, like, you know, very, very deep vertical hole and then a horizontal hole, and then do it again, like a kind of like a mirror image. And then you have basically a way in and a way out, right? And then, you know, when the water is injected into it, the steam would come out like the other hole, you know, not the hole that's injecting the water. And then there's another approach that this company, Evor is doing. It's called a closed loop approach. And this is essentially exactly like what geothermal is in the home, on the home level, except it's much deeper and, you know, much, much, much more dangerous and complicated. But this closed loop approach is, it involves like drilling sealed pipes into the hot rocks, right? So the water is not touching the rocks. The water's inside the pipes, but you pump the water down into the pipes, and then it turns into steam, you know, it picks up an incredible amount of energy from the heat. And then, you know, on the other side, you know, you have the heat energy coming out as steam. And then you have a generator there, but it's not just putting water out into the rock. It all stays inside the pipes. So the main factor that's driving interest in expanding geothermal energy is this constant need, of course, for more clean energy solutions than we have today. And we need them to operate consistently, you know, meaning 24 hours a day. Now, particularly during times when wind and solar energy production fluctuates, right? So wind and solar have made huge technological strides. They're doing really, really good. They're kicking ass, you know, like every time you look at the charts and read what they're capable of doing, how much energy they collect and everything, the numbers just keep going up, the costs keep going down. But they still and always will need backup energy sources, or at least, you know, we need to have this amazingly aggressive, you know, batteries connected to our grid to store the energy. And a lot of experts are saying, you know, it's very unlikely that we're going to get to that, especially in the short term. So geothermal energy could potentially fill this gap that we need to fill when we're using solar and wind. And, you know, look, it's a reliable carbon-free alternative. It's there's a lot of untapped potential here. There's challenges and risks, of course, that come with this. Fracking could, you know, cause earthquakes, and, you know, they have to be very careful about how they're handling that. Allowing these kinds of projects takes a lot of time, and it has a complex process, especially if it's happening on federal property. There's a lot of regulatory reviews that take years and years. You know how slow governments can move on stuff like this. And, you know, again, you know, the government, the U.S. government in particular, isn't funding geothermal anywhere near its funding wind, solar, and hydrogen. So I personally have a lot of hope for this technology. It seems almost like a no-brainer, right? It's clean. We're using technologies that we already have. You know, we just need them to get more refined, and we need, you know, them to basically get to the finish line now. Like these companies are trying to do it. They're looking for funding. And who knows what the future will bring, but I am guessing, you know, I think that this is very likely to happen. It's not going to happen quickly, again, because, you know, the money isn't there yet. But I do think that in the, you know, within the next 10 to 20 years, like geothermal could be a huge, huge supply of energy, as long as things go well.
Yeah, I think there's no question that there's going to be increased geothermal going forward. The only question is how much. Yep. And the how much really depends on how deep you have to dig. So, like, you know, all forms of energy, we need to pick the low-hanging fruit first. There are locations where you don't have to drill that deep to get basically to build a geothermal plant. So we could do all of that. Then there are ones where you have to drill deeper, but within our current drilling technology. And then there's the deep, you know, geothermal, where we're basically like, yeah, we've got to, like, we've got to develop the drilling technology itself to be able to drill deeper and economically. And that's the big question mark. So it's really just a matter of how much we're going to have based on how deep we need to dig. And I've read estimates that, 10 to 15% is kind of the low-hanging fruit in terms of like our existing energy demand in the U.S. Other countries will have a lot more. This is very region-specific. It just depends on your country. And I agree that also like the main advantage here, you glossed over kind of a lot of debate and controversy about like how much wind and solar can we really get to. And it really depends on grid storage. If with enough grid storage, we could have 100% wind and solar. Like there's no question about that. But enough grid storage is a lot of freaking grid storage. And it's still questionable how quickly and how much we're going to be able to develop things like closed loop hydro. If that turns out to be something that we can do in the next 20 years, then that would give a huge boon to wind and solar. But the big advantage to like hydro, geothermal, and nuclear right now is that they just require a single connection to the grid. And it could be an existing connection. And they can produce a lot of electricity and you just plug into an existing grid infrastructure. The biggest hurdle with wind and solar is that it's more than the intermittency, is that it's widely distributed. We have a backlog of years of new connections to the grid. And we need lots of grid upgrade if we're going to be able to move like solar power from one place to another or wind power from one place to another. And so that may be the limiting factor. So things that can just like swap out coal or natural gas for another large, baseload source, there's a huge advantage to that in terms of how quickly we could decarbonize our energy infrastructure, right? If it didn't matter how long it took, then we could say, okay, we'll just do all wind and solar, however long it takes. But we don't have that luxury. We got to do it as quickly as possible, which means we got to pick the low hanging fruit of every type of energy and every type of low carbon energy. And then the final thing about geothermal, I think, is that it's one technological breakthrough away from like being an order of magnitude like more important than these more modest projections. All right, Bob, tell us about this failed star. Why are astronomers excited about this?
Yeah, radiation belts. Now, radiation belts like Earth and Jupiter's have for the first time been found outside our solar system, and they're around a brown dwarf. Why should we even care about this? We shouldn't. Back to you, Steve. Oh, wait. I got a few more things to say.
It does not impact my immediate...
I totally lied. The leads on this paper are Melody Cao, fellow at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Professor Evgenia Shulnik of ASU School of Earth and Space Exploration, published in Nature on May 15th. Now, it's easy not to think about radiation belts, even though one begins, look straight up, 1,000 kilometers straight up. There's the beginning of a radiation belt. I personally don't see a lot of news items about them. I haven't come across them in a while, and I'm always kind of looking around for something. But they are fascinating regardless, and it looks like they just got way more fascinating. Radiation belts are donut-shaped magnetic structures found around the planets and moons in our solar system that have essentially large-scale magnetic fields around them. So Earth, Jupiter, other gas giants, some moons as well. And all of these radiation belts are filled with charged particles, high-energy electrons and protons. That's what you find in them. Sometimes you find more protons in one and more electrons in the other, but it's essentially high energy, electrons, and protons. Now, it's believed that the electrons and protons come from our sun's solar wind, and they just get permanently trapped in our own magnetosphere. You may be thinking about auroras right now, and if you are, I send you a polite but earnest golf clap right now. The aurora borealis and the aurora australis, otherwise known as the northern and southern lights, are probably caused by those same electrons and protons trapped in the radiation belts, but some of them get channeled by the magnetosphere down to the Earth's polar regions when the solar activity warrants it. And then there they interact with the atmosphere and they produce the beautiful glow that we know as the northern and southern lights. Now, our own inner and outer radiation belts were discovered in 1958 by the first American satellite called, come on, people, the first American satellite.
That's a then.
Telstar?
What? Not Bad State, but it was Explorer 1.
Oh, that's good trivia right there.
It is. It is. I didn't think of it either.
Everyone knows. It's weird. Everyone knows Sputnik.
Oh, my God.
Soviet Union. Nobody knows Explorer 1.
Right? Explorer 1. Now, but this was very, you know, an important thing, an important satellite for many reasons. Space scientist James Van Allen and his team were behind this discovery, and the belts are still called the Van Allen belts to this day. You may come across that term, but they are dangerous areas for sure. They interfere with electronics and satellites. They can harm or even kill astronauts. But limited exposure is safe. You know, it's safe enough. You can fly through it without really worrying about it. I mean, if you went outside of your ship, you wouldn't even notice it. If you're just even floating right in the middle of one, but your instruments would certainly notice it. Now, Jupiter, as you might imagine, has monster radiation belts, many, many times more powerful than the Earth's. They're actually recognized as one of the most hazardous areas of the solar system, besides Ooh. Jay's bathroom, of course. So charged particles from the sun and, interestingly, volcanism on Jupiter's moon Io are what we believe cause a good chunk of these radiation belts in Jupiter. These charged particles are accelerated within the belt like accelerators on Earth, like the LHC, Large Hadron Collider. So if you landed on Jupiter's moon Europa within one of these belts, some estimates say that you would get a lethal dose in hours. Like, you got a lethal dose. It's a deadly place. And of course, nearby, if you had electronics nearby you, on Europa, you know, it would meet a similar fate. When the aliens in Arthur C. Clarke's sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey, called 2010, when those aliens said, all these worlds are yours except Europa, attempt no landing there, maybe they had our safety in mind. Said, dudes, don't go to Europa. That's a deadly place. Stay away. I don't think that's what they had in mind, though, at all, Steve, so don't worry. Okay, so we have identified these radiation belts in our solar system. Okay, that's fine. Well, how common are they? Well, we don't know, but we now have one new massive new data point, and it doesn't involve a planet or a moon, but a brown dwarf. Now, brown dwarfs are – these are oddball astronomical objects. They are, really are bizarre. They're at a huge 13 to 80 Jupiter masses. They're heavy. They could be up to 80 times the mass of Jupiter. They're too big. So they're too big to be a planet, and they're not big enough to sustain hydrogen fusion in their cores. So they're not really considered true stars either. You'll often hear them referred to as a failed star or a substellar objects, which is fair enough. But they do fuse deuterium and even lithium if you're over 65 Jupiter masses. I say, if you fuse new elements in your core, you're a star. I call you a star. That's just me. All right, so the nearest brown dwarf to us is called LSR J1835, blah, 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 whatever. I'm going to call it LSR. It's only 18.5 years away. That, to be fair, this is a brown dwarf binary. It's a binary pair, but we're only talking about one of them. LSR, I'll call it. It's only 18.5 light years away. It's right in our backyard. In fact, the term backyard in this case is inadequate. That's so close, it's basically touching the deck that's attached to the back of our house. It's like right there. It's the third closest system to us after Alpha Centauri and Barnard's star. I mean, it's just stupid close. 18.5 light years is nothing. Relatively speaking,
let's send a probe there with a solar sail. Let's get there.
Yeah. So because LSR is so close, though, that's why we are able to see its radio emissions in such great great detail and make this breakthrough that they have made. In fact, the image resolution they got, which surprised the hell out of me, it was 50 times better than even the James Webb Space Telescope. 50 times better than JWST. So how could that even be? They did this by using very long baseline interferometry, VLBI. So they coordinated 39 radio dishes all over the Earth, from Hawaii to Germany, to create, in a real sense, a telescope the size of the Earth. Not in a full sense, but in a realistic sense, the telescope for some purposes is the size of the Earth when you spread it out over many, many radio dishes like that. So this is how they imaged the black hole recently that was all over the news. Was it last year, a year or two ago? They used this very similar technique. And without this technique, that brown dwarf would have just looked like a point of light, just like pretty much any other star. It really wouldn't have been able to infer really much at all. So this very long baseline interferometry technique was critical. So they were able to actually resolve the dynamic magnetic field around the brown dwarf, its magnetosphere. This is the first time this has been done, and its shape and nature was recognizably similar to Earth's, and even more so, it was more similar to Jupiter's, in fact. Now, from what they can infer, as you might imagine, the radiation belts around this brown dwarf, it belied its name. Some estimates put it at 10 million times more intense than Jupiter's. 10 million times more intense of a radiation belt than Jupiter. So how long would an astronaut last near this, regardless of gravity or anything else, just the radiation belt? So it's hard to say how long an astronaut would last, but if you extrapolate from Europa, mm-hmm. if a lethal dose in Europa you would get in a few hours. So what's 1/10,000,000th of 3 hours? I figured 1/1,000th of a second you would last, and you would have a deadly dose in just a sub-second. That's going to be a very, very nasty place to get close to. All right, so that's the radiation belt. But what does the aurora look like on this brown dwarf? Now, imagine right now a classic aurora on the Earth. We've all seen the pictures, right?
That nice green,
amazing, among the most beautiful. Yes. Images, the most beautiful things you could see in the night sky, arguably in
everyone
the
but Bob
I saw one.
It.
I saw one.
Oh, you did.
Decades ago, it went way down into Connecticut. It was light. You know, it was not a dramatic one, but you could still get the sense of the beauty of an aurora borealis. So imagine that. Okay, now multiply that by about 1,000,000, and that's the aurora you would probably see.
So we're blind.
On this brown dwarf, maybe you might need radio eyes to see it. I'm not sure what the actual wavelength would be, but that's 1,000,000 times the intensity of a classic aurora on the Earth. Amazing. But it gets even better. That's not even the really good stuff. The researchers speculate that there may be an exoplanet in this system. An exoplanet. Now, they think it perhaps, if it exists, there's no real hard evidence, but if it exists, it would exist perhaps like Jupiter in the sense that there's a body in a close orbit that's supplying many of the charged particles that compose its radiation belts and auroras. So there may be some volcanism on this exoplanet that is spewing out the charged particles that the brown dwarf then accelerates and causes such a nasty environment and creating the radiation belt and creating the occasional auroras. Now, I love the lead scientist on this, Melody Cow's analogy of a radiation belt. She compares it to a yard, but she said the yard doesn't have flowers. It has glowing energetic particles. And then I'll quote her directly here to finish this. She said, the particular properties of each radiation belt tells us something about that planet's energetic, magnetic, and particle resources. How quickly it's spinning. How strong is the magnetic field? How close it lives to the sun? Does it have moons that can supply more particles? Or does it have rings like Saturn that will absorb them? And more. For the first time, we're able to see what sorts of yards brown dwarfs and low-mass stars have. I'm excited for the day that we can learn about the magnetospheric yards inhabited by exoplanets. So really interesting, the fact that we could use these radio signals to infer what the radiation belt and auroras look like on these distant brown dwarfs, that eventually, hopefully in the future, we could then fine-tune this technique so that we could look at them for exoplanets. And then by observing this radiation belt on the exoplanet, we can determine all of these details about the exoplanet, about its spin, its magnetic field, how close to the sun, all these things we can infer just by interpreting these radio signals that were emitted by the radiation belt. Fascinating stuff. Thank you for your time. Back to you, Steve.
So that's why astronomers are excited.
Yes.
All right. Evan, Tell us about this doctor who thinks that near-death experiences are real.
Oh, God. Real what, though? Real
here you
what?
Go, Bob. put aside the Van Allen belt for now. Pick this one up. I read this at a website called Inside.com. It was featured on Yahoo.com's website, and seeing as how I have a Yahoo-based email, I get all kinds of updates and news flashed at me. Comes at me a million miles an hour. So this was one of them, an article about a doctor named Jeffrey Long. Jeffrey Long is a medical doctor specializing in the practice of radiation oncology. That's, yep, radiation to treat cancer. Dr. Long is also the founder of something called the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. And I went to their website and I looked at their mission statement, and here's what it says: to research and study consciousness experiences and to spread the message of love, unity, and peace around the world. The banner on their homepage reads, "Where science and spirituality come together." Okay, all right. As a scientist, Jeff founded this organization in 1998. He wanted to know if near-death experiences, NDEs, I'm going to call them going forward, if they were real, by directly asking the people who have experienced these things. And the answer is a resounding yes. As a result of his research, he was able to author a New York Times bestseller book called Evidence of the Afterlife, The Science of Near-Death Experiences. And he's written some other stuff. He's been on all the major networks, you know, all the TV shows, Oprah, Dr. Oz. The only place I didn't see him was Goop. But he's pretty much been everywhere talking about this stuff for a long time. He says that studying near-death experiences, sorry, NDEs, has made him a better cancer doctor. Do I need to explain what a near-death experience is? Do you want to hear
it? Well, give a bullet.
Yeah, well, here's his definition. I mean, these are his words. A near-death experience is someone who is either comatose or clinically dead without a heartbeat, having a lucid experience where they see, hear, feel emotions, and interact with other beings. That definition, I think, needs some clarity, right, Steve? I mean, clinically dead?
Yeah, it depends on how you define it.
Right.
So in most studies of NDEs, it's just defined as the heart is stopped. A period of time when there is no spontaneous heartbeat. Often people are undergoing CPR, you know, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, during that time. That's considered, quote-unquote, clinically dead.
Right. Clinically dead. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So, yeah. So there's the hard definition of it. Now, he came across – so he was in his practice. He was a resident at the time, the late 1980s, and he was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. He came across an article describing NDEs. And here's what he said. It stopped me in my tracks. All my medical training told me you were either dead or alive. There was no in between. But suddenly...
Really? What course are you on? Yeah,
right. All his medical training told him this, Steve. But suddenly he was reading about a cardiologist describing patients who had died and then came back to life, reporting very distinct and almost unbelievable experiences. And from that moment, he was fascinated with NDEs. So yeah, his organization collects stories from people who have these experiences, and then he, these are his words, evaluates them in the mind of a scientist and a doctor. I've made opinions based on evidence and came to this as a skeptic, but in the face of overwhelming evidence, I've come to believe there's certainly an afterlife.
Bullshit.
I'm a medical doctor. He's
already thrown that authority away,
right,
with the hyperbole that he's been using. You're not either alive or dead. There's a pretty big continuum between those two things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like your heart could be stopped, but your brain can still be functioning, for example. And that's a pretty big, you know, point if we're talking about experiences that are remembered after somebody revives. He's clearly not coming at this from a skeptic, scientific point of view, medical background point of view. He wants to believe this.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. It's amazing that he's able to say that and has been saying this for decades with basically a straight face. And
or he's been bedazzled by the idea of it and is just engaging in motivated reasoning. But what's inexcusable is that he's promoting basically a religious belief by citing some kind of skeptical scientific authority, and that's BS.
That is exactly right. He's an oncologist, as I said before. He says here, I'm a medical doctor, but I've read brain research and considered every possible explanation for NDEs. The bottom line is none of them hold water. There isn't even a remotely plausible physical explanation for this phenomenon. Steve, those are his words exactly. I pulled that.
Yeah, which also, I mean, right there again, he's totally full of it because, you know, there are absolutely plausible explanations. He's not even addressing the most plausible explanation, which is that the memories that people are recalling didn't happen when they were, you know, quote unquote, clinically dead. And research to prove that it's happening during a period of time with no brain activity have failed.
Mm-hmm.
They have failed to demonstrate that anything is happening at a time when you can document no brain activity. So wrong. That statement is a straight up wrong. Either he is just ignorant of the topic he professes expertise on, or, you know, he is being intellectually insane.
This is argument from authority, Steve, is it not? I mean, this oncologist basically
said... Partly, but he's also saying, making specific factual claims, which are just not true.
Yeah.
He's a punk.
He goes on. I mean, there's parts in here in which he talks about... Oh, you know, what it boils down to is that he says his research, and he has studied apparently more than 5,400 cases, okay, through his organization for whatever that's worth. And he said, here's the thing. He said, my day job still revolves around helping patients fight cancer. I don't tell my patients about my NDE research, and yet my work with NDEs has made me a more compassionate and loving doctor. I'm able to help my patients face life-threatening diseases with increased courage and passion. My goal is to help them have more healthy days here on Earth, but I firmly believe that if and when they pass, they will be at peace.
Yeah, it's just all subjective.
Steve, will he be writing for Science-Based Medicine anytime soon, submitting an article?
Yeah, I
don't. I'd be happy
to engage in a written debate with him on SBM or elsewhere.
You recall, Steve, it was, oh my gosh, it's coming up on 10 years in which you had your debate, you and Sean Carroll.
That's right.
Against proponents of near-death experiences.
Yeah, where we kicked ass.
You did. You moved the needle. Right?
By the rules of the debate, we won.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it was significant, too. It wasn't just a small blip. You convinced a good chunk of that audience to think differently about this after it was all said and done.
Yeah, but I mean, the bottom line is, as a scientific question, they haven't proven that NDEs are a phenomenon, you know, that they are anything other than just brain activity occurring sometime around the entire experience, right? Because they haven't been able to demonstrate any mental activity when the brain is not functional. That's it. Until they do that, they have nothing. Nothing.
Nothing.
All right, let's move on. Right. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Short and sweet. What do you guys think?
Friction. Something experiencing friction.
Yes, you are correct.
Excellent. I win.
Random sound created by an AI.
AI's interpretation of that sound.
A listener named Will Beldman wrote in and said, hi, Jay, based on your hint, I think it sounds like taping up a hockey stick. Because remember, I gave the clue that it's sport related.
Oh, yes.
If that's it, this person is probably a pro because this person is able to tape up the blade in one continuous smooth motion. You are incorrect, but I do appreciate the visualization of somebody doing that very quickly. Visto Tutti had something to say. He said a rhythmic scraping, sweeping sound, then pause, and did I hear a click? I think this is the sound of the sport of curling. And then he goes on to describe it. Curling is the ancient sport of guiding the path of large stones on frozen lakes without touching them.
More like guidelines.
And the curling stones go back to 1511. Everybody here probably has seen the video of people curling, and then they have the people with the brooms and whatnot and all that. I always find that fascinating. But that is incorrect, my friend. I have another listener named Portia Schumanns. And she says, good morning from Canada. It sounds to me like sharpening ice skates. Thanks and have a nice day. And then there was a listener from Alberta, Canada, named Maxie B, 11 years old, listening to the podcast while my father's driving. Is the noise ice skates being sharpened? So I got many, many people guessed that it was ice skates being sharpened. Maxie, thank you for listening to the show. I appreciate it. I hope you grow up to be a scientist. It is not ice skates being sharpened, but there's a little bit of a step in the right direction. I have another guess here from Keely Hill, and Keely says, given the hint, I think it's an automatic ball lacing sewing machine. I have no idea what the hell that is, and I wanted to know if any of you guys know it. What's a ball lacing sewing machine?
The term ball lacing? I don't know
that. Yeah, I've never heard of that before. Well, Keely, send me in a link to a sound of that. I'd like to hear that. No, but it is not that. But
to look it up.
The important word here when people made these guesses in ice skates was ice. So this, nobody got it, and I knew it was going to be hard. This is an ice screw. This is a screw that ice climbers use to essentially make a point that they can hook on a safety line or whatever, right? So they have to screw into the ice in order to make like this stable point, and then they would use that for climbing, right? Can you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But the weird thing is when this screw is screwed in, like it's pushing out ice shavings out the middle of it, and they just come out as the screw goes in. So take a quick listen again. Right, so that's.
So I was right, friction.
Yes, that's the person turning the screw around, and it goes in very, must be super sharp, the teeth on that thing.
Friction based on an inclined plane.
Yeah. Very cool, though. I don't know much about ice climbing other than it's dangerous, but that is one of the tools that they need in order to pull it off. So I have a new noisy this week. I have this noisy sent in from a listener named Anthony Morgan, and here it is. If you think you know what this week's noisy is, or you heard something cool, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, as people hear this, we will have already been to Dragon Con, so I know I don't need to mention Dragon Con. But what we do need to mention is Nauticon, which is our conference.
Let's go.
Which is not really a conference because we're doing things at this gathering that are non-conference like. If you've been to other skeptical or science conferences, it's not going to be that. It's a totally different concept. This conference revolves around two things: us entertaining you and you having time to socialize with the people that are at the conference, because this is what people have been asking us for years to do, right? They want social activity. So we're giving you social activity. This will be happening on November 3rd and 4th. We have a lot of awesome things planned for those 2 days. A couple of things I want to tell you guys, even though this show is going to come out a couple weeks later, everything I say is still relevant. First and foremost, it's not too late. There are still tickets left. I did ask for more seating and everything. I had to arrange for that. So we do have some more seats available. So please do buy tickets. This will be in White Plains, New York, at the Sonesta Hotel in White Plains. We have Brian Wecht, George Robb, Andrea Jones-Roy, and everybody from the SGU will be there. We have all different types of crazy events planned for the day. You can go to notaconcon.com to find out more information. We have some, the schedule will be up very soon if it's not up by the time you go there when you hear this. So please do join us. It's not too late. We'd love to have you. We're going to have a great time. There is also the very strong potential for there to be a conference dinner, which will cost $49. At this point, it's very likely to happen, and it'll be a separate ticketed event that I will put up as a separate Eventbrite. If you're interested, you can buy tickets for that. And a couple last things. One thing you could do to help the show is you could just give us a rating on whatever podcast player you're using. Most people go to Apple Podcasts to read reviews and everything, so that'd be great if you could do that. And also, you could become a patron if you appreciate the work that we do.
Okay, thanks, Jay. Well, we have a great interview coming up, so let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Anna Blakeney. Anna, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you are an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia in the Michael Smith Labs and School of Biomedical Engineering. It seems that your research focus deals with various aspects of RNA. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
But we're going to talk to you at least at first, about your social media activity, because you're a science communicator, just like the rest of us. We appreciate that. So tell us what you do. Tell us about your science communication.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, yeah, maybe I'll give you a little bit of the backstory here. So I run a TikTok account that is dedicated to educating people about RNA vaccines and therapies. I'm primarily a TikTok purist, although I do also have an Instagram account where I cross post reels. But yeah, it's mainly to just really kind of be able to show people how we make and characterize and test RNA vaccines in the lab and answer any questions that people may have come up.
And how long have you been doing that?
So I started in October of 2020. So kind of right at an interesting time when, you know, there were lots of vaccines in development for COVID, but none of them had been approved yet. And so I was actually invited to join this organization called Team Halo that was started by the United Nations and the Vaccine Confidence Project. And so their whole goal was to just get more scientists and clinicians who were working on COVID-19 on TikTok specifically to just be able to answer questions and kind of educate people about the progress.
Do you have any mechanism for evaluating your effectiveness, or you define that in any way, or you just want to be a resource?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I've had many conversations about this with people, and interested to hear your guys' thoughts on this as well, which is, you know, there's many metrics that you can have on the app, right? There's all these analytics about how many people see a post or comment or like a post or share a post. And, you know, all of that is well and good, but obviously is very influenced by the algorithm and the actual content there. I think for me, kind of a personal measure of this, or what I value, is really more the interactions that I see in the comments. So something that I have been really, I guess, surprised by, but also pleased by, is that there is actually sometimes really good discussions in the comments. So people asking questions, answering questions, people kind of sharing their experiences. And so for me, that's what I find much more rewarding and valuable, as opposed to just how many followers you have or how many people have viewed your videos.
Yeah, we've been doing, I don't know if Jay told you when he was setting this up, but we've been doing science communication on TikTok for about 6 months now.
Mm-hmm. Well, since the beginning of the year.
Beginning of the year, yeah. Okay, so 8 months. So we've been, we engage in the comments as well, and man, that's a mixed bag. I mean, I'm sure you know. I mean, there's some of the comments you get. You're like, do I even engage here? Like, how do you have a way of figuring out, like, is this worth engaging with? It's obviously good. It's all good, but man, sometimes you have to wonder if it's worth. Trying to deal with something.
It's really funny. I feel like I could probably write a whole like book on just TikTok as a scientist. It's so different from what I normally do, right? Because, you know, I mean, usually I'm talking to crowds of people that all like are on the same page, right? Like they may be skeptical about certain parts of my science, but they all are like understand RNA and vaccines and whatnot, right? So for me, what I try to stay really grounded in is my mission of being there. So for me, I'm not there to try to convince people to get vaccines. I'm purely there to educate people about the science I do and you know, mRNA technology in general. And so I think that really also helps me to kind of check my attitude about what I'm trying to do there and my interactions with people. I'm not trying to argue. I'm not trying to like really convince somebody to get a vaccine. I'm really just there to answer their questions. So if people have good questions, happy to engage and answer them and, you know, kind of go back and forth. But if people are just there to troll or like be really negative, like that's not the energy I'm there for. So it's pretty easy for me to just pass that by. But yeah, what has your guys' experience been like?
How much time do you have?
So, you know, we are skeptical science communicators. So, mm-hmm. we do take that approach sometimes, and we have multiple. We're also not purists. We do everything, whatever social media we go wind our way into. So we take that approach of like we're here as a resource, and for the media, for people who have questions, but we're also as skeptical science communicators. Like we are supposed to be addressing the conspiracy theories and the mm-hmm. pseudoscience,
right?
And the critical thinking aspects of it. So we delve into that as long as we think there is something productive to get out of it.
Yeah.
And then there are just sometimes. First of all, like there's one class of people we have a conversation sometimes. Like, is this guy for real, or is this performance?
Yeah.
Because we don't want to get sucked into that. You know, I mean, we don't want to deal with somebody who's not even sincere. They're just trying to goose their own TikTok ratings, you know. Or the other sort of line is this guy, I'm using guy in a gender neutral way, is this person on the fringes of mental illness? Like, we don't want to go down that road either. But if we think, like, okay, they're stating a conspiracy theory, this is, and so we're going to address this. Not even necessarily for them, but for other people who might be reading the comments.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I actually, you know, mRNA vaccines, I think, especially over the past few years, there's lots of conspiracy theories about all these things, right? And so, yeah, I haven't been, you know, I actually don't try to ignore that or like go out of my way to avoid talking about conspiracy theories. I think it's actually really good sometimes to just confront these things head on. I think exactly as you've said of just, you know, just you have to kind of do a temperature check of just like maybe who is this person I'm about to engage with, but it's so hard to tell. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. But one of the things I always like really try to do when I'm doing this is have data to back me up or at least present kind of the data that's most relevant or most cutting edge. And so, yeah, whenever I go into any of these like theories, I try to have like some sort of data to point to in that conversation.
Anna, mm-hmm. you keep going on about RNA. Does that stand for Rotor Nacelle Assembly or Radio Network Association?
Oh, good question.
Could be any of the above. It could also be ribonucleic acid.
That initialization.
Yeah, it depends on who That's you're talking about,
right? Got it. All right, I'm on board. I get it.
Yeah, you know, Bob has a sort of a different science emphasis.
Yeah, it's called science fiction.
Any deep lessons learned in the last few years of science communicating, not just about TikTok, but just about, because you were in the fire with the RNA vaccines during the pandemic. You were on the front lines of misinformation. So what, anything that really surprised you or that you said, oh, I really had to change my strategy because of your experience?
Yeah, maybe a few things regarding that. So I think for me, the biggest lesson that I've learned in the past few years, the biggest realization that I've had is that there is just such a gap between scientific progress and what the public knows about. And, you know, this was really kind of put under the magnifying glass for mRNA vaccines. I guess to give you an example, if you think back to January 2020, there were still very few scientists, even in like the drug delivery field, that knew about mRNA vaccines and, you know, knew about the clinical trials and kind of all the work that had been done to get there, right? So, and that was like scientists, you know, people who you think would be more privy to this information. And so as you can imagine, like the average person just had no idea what an mRNA vaccine was. And then all of a sudden, billions of people are getting these vaccines, right? And so I think, you know, just from my observations, and there's been lots of studies and social science studies about this now, just as far as, you know, some of the questions that people were asking about, you know, does RNA, you know, is it safe? Does it change your DNA? These are actually questions that scientists were asking, you know, about a decade ago when these vaccines were really first starting to come online. Scientists asked those same questions as well. It's just, you know, then we did the studies and learned about how they actually worked and the mechanisms. And, you know, we know they don't change your DNA, but the perfectly valid questions. It's just the pace that we communicate our findings to the public is just so slow. So, you know, we really saw this for mRNA vaccines in the past few years, but it was kind of a wake up call for me for so many different things, right? It's not just RNA vaccines, it's climate science, it's all these different things that I think we just do as scientists, like we're really, you know, focused on our research and communicating to other researchers, but we don't do enough science communication as a whole.
Anna, can you distinguish RNA-based vaccines with conventional vaccines?
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever I'm kind of explaining what's different, I just try to think about like, what are we trying to do with a vaccine? Like, what does a vaccine do? So with any vaccine, we're trying to train your immune system to recognize a foreign pathogen, ideally without ever having seen that pathogen. So for example, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, we're trying to train your immune system to recognize a protein on the surface of that virus. And there's many ways we can train your immune system. So we could give you the virus itself. We could make that protein in a lab and give you just that protein. Or what mRNA vaccines do is we give your cells the code to make that protein in your own body. And that is what trains your immune system to recognize it. So historically, we've used kind of all these other different ways of vaccinating people, you know, with viruses or inactivated viruses or proteins, or subunit vaccines. It's all just different ways of getting these proteins into your body.
That was great.
Have you noticed a change over the last few years? Like, do you think we've turned a corner? Like, do people get it now? You know, obviously not everybody, but just in general, do you find the public, like the needle has moved on in terms of the public understanding and acceptance?
Yeah, I think that to me is maybe a positive outcome of the pandemic, if you can even really say that, is just I think there has been an increase in the global knowledge about virology and immunology and vaccines. You know, even I think to put it into perspective, if you think about maybe if you've ever gotten a flu vaccine in the past or a tetanus vaccine, like, did you know the manufacturer of that vaccine or what type of vaccine it was when you were getting it?
No.
Probably not.
Probably not, right? And so now, you know, people know the manufacturers, they know the different types of vaccines. And so I think people's vaccine literacy has actually really improved. I notice it even just talking into my friends and family who, you know, aren't scientists, but before the pandemic, you know, I would always tell my parents or my friends, I'm working on RNA vaccines. And they'd be like, okay, great. Like, I don't really get what that means. Right now, whenever I talk to people, they're like, oh yeah, how's the new vaccines looking? Like, how are those antibody levels looking? And it's like, everybody just knows so much more about the field. And so I think, you know, I do think there has been kind of just an increased level of learning that has taken place.
That's encouraging because my knee-jerk assessment would be that acceptance has definitely gone up, but actual understanding of what's going on under the hood is maybe not as nearly as good as just the general acceptance of them. But you're engaging, you know, more than I am, so I think that's encouraging. I'm happy that that's your reaction.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think like we're really at the point we need to be at with the education and kind of what everybody knows. But to me, I think there was kind of a net positive change for that in the past few years.
Good.
Can I ask you the reaction of your university at any level to your social media engagement?
Yeah,
that's a really good question. You know, I always joke about like, I'm just waiting for the day that UBC sends me like a cease and desist for my social media. But no, they're very supportive. You know, I think I actually, in 2021, I have an award up on my wall. I won the President's Award for Public Education through Media. So all the feedback I've gotten is that people are very supportive and pro using it. I think the only challenge is like maybe with the platform itself, with TikTok. I think there's a lot of, I think at least this year has been more controversy, especially in Canada. So now you're like technically not allowed to use that on government phones. And so I think if anything, the real risk is like for the platform itself. But yeah, other than that, no, I think it's like very supportive because honestly, I do think social media is a great tool for scientists. It's just, you're able to reach so many more and such different populations of people than you normally have access to.
And what about the boomers? How do you reach out to them? Because most of them, most of them are not on TikTok. So there have to be other things, other ways.
That's right. So, you know, I think all these different social media platforms, they kind of have their own identities. I think TikTok for sure historically was a much younger population. I think that average age is getting older now, but maybe not like quite comprehensive of the boomer generation. I know that some people have like real strategies around this. I don't know that I have like an intentional strategy necessarily, but I think you probably reach a few more people with Instagram, but I actually think that generation probably mainly uses Facebook. And so actually when I was like really involved with Team Halo and doing a lot of TikTok stuff with them, I know that that was like one of their strategies was actually getting videos on Facebook and Twitter as well, actually at the time. So I think you kind of have to embrace all these different platforms because especially it's different in every country all over the world, right? As to what people are actually using. So, it's a whole world out there for sure.
I think Steve is the only boomer on TikTok. Is that right, Steve?
I was referred to as decrepit in one.
Oh, congratulations. Oh, my God. A new milestone.
You're not decrepit yet.
So I'm glad to hear that your university is supportive. But I'm a fellow academician, so that's why I'm very interested in this. But when you say supportive, how supportive are they? And specifically, like, do you get academic credit for your public outreach on social media?
Yeah, you know, every year in my like merit review, I include that in it. And I've gotten advice from colleagues of like how to highlight that in my CV, which is good. Kind of the main way of communication. But yeah, I have a blurb about it. And because I mean, if you think about it, I've created hundreds of outreach videos, right? And so they happen to be on TikTok, but that is a lot of time and content and education. And so I've always kind of wondered about that. Like, do, you know, my like more senior colleagues view this as a plus when they're looking at my CV? I don't know that I've ever gotten like formal feedback on that, but everybody like who I've talked to, first of all, it comes up at the beginning of basically any conversation I have with people, because as soon as you Google my name, that's like one of the first things you see. So everybody's aware of it. But I do think it is actually academically valued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I've been doing it for about 20 years, and it's changed over that time.
Mm-hmm.
It started out as, that's weird. You know, they didn't really know what to make of it. Maybe even a negative. Then it kind of turned into it's fine that you're doing that, but it doesn't count for anything. Mm-hmm. And now maybe it's like a plus, you know, it's like, okay, that's good that you're doing that. That's, we'll count that as legitimate, even though it's not the same as other academic activity.
Yeah, I think exactly. It takes time for that view to change too. I mean, I don't think it's like, you know, can become my main emphasis in life. I think there's still things that are valued way higher than that, but I do think it is appreciated.
Anna, do you think it's challenging for your average scientist or researcher to be able to effectively communicate online like you're doing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a huge challenge for me, right? I get wake-up calls all the time on TikTok of, you know, I'll be explaining a concept or something about a vaccine, and someone in the comments will say, oh, what is a protein? And so you just have to really take a step back and remember like, oh, right. Not everybody is, you know, dreaming and thinking about RNA vaccines 24/7. So it makes you kind of, or like makes me realize kind of what a niche I'm in and how I'm surrounded by people who think about similar things to me all the time. But yeah, that's a huge challenge for sure, is just being able to explain these concepts such that people can actually understand them. You know, we spend so much of our time training a scientist to communicate at a higher technical level through writing and presentations. And honestly, I think it's actually more of a challenge to understand it at that high technical level and then be able to boil it back down so that you don't lose the technical content, but you're still getting the message across such that the average person can understand it.
Yeah, not oversimplifying or worse.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen examples of that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's challenging to, as you say, to get people to understand the essence, to be correct at the level that you're explaining it, and without introducing misconceptions or error. Or the big problem I find is introducing gratuitous hype.
Right.
You know, which yes. There's always like, you know, like the siren, you know, trying to call you to do that to get more engagement. But it really has, I think, a detrimental effect on the actual teaching that you're doing.
Yep, exactly. And I think there is that balance is really important to keep in mind, right? Because, you know, probably the pulls from the TikTok side are to over sensationalize things and simplify them and make them really exciting, right? But wearing my professor's scientist hat, it's more to just be very, very specific in the language about the claims that you're making, right? So when reviewer two comes back to you, you haven't misspoken about or misrepresented your data. And so those two things, like they are very polar opposite, right? So it's definitely mm-hmm. just a constant challenge to end up in the right balance between those.
Can we talk a little bit about your RNA research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are you most focused on right now?
Yeah, so my lab works on a specific type of messenger RNA called self-amplifying RNA. Have you guys heard of this technology?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's, for those who aren't aware, it's just a type of messenger RNA that's able to replicate once it gets into cells. So this gives us a number of advantages. It means we can use a much lower dose of mRNA. It's usually about 100 times less, but we can also express protein for a lot longer. So a typical mRNA expresses protein in vivo for about 3 to 5 days, whereas for saRNA, that's about 30 to 60 days.
Whoa.
So when we're thinking about, you know, giving a patient a therapy, it means that instead of dosing every 3 to 5 days, theoretically, you could be dosing every 30 to 60 days. So once a month or once every 2 months.
Now, the existing like mRNA vaccines that are out there are not self-replicating.
They are not. No, there is actually an approved saRNA vaccine that's approved against COVID-19 in India. So that was developed by a company in Seattle called HDT Bio. So there is an approved saRNA vaccine, but the first two, the Pfizer and BioNTech and the Moderna, those are just non-replicating messenger RNA vaccines.
I'm not familiar with that vaccine. Is the thinking that it would be just more effective, or would it also increase the time between boosters?
Yeah, I think the jury's still out on whether it increases the duration of immunity. I don't think that's really been shown for an saRNA vaccine yet, but that is part of the idea and the hypothesis there. But in the approved saRNA vaccine, it is at a lower dose. So it's at a dose of 5 micrograms compared to the 30 or 50 micrograms that are approved for mRNA. So this is also, you know, a huge advantage when we think about scaling these vaccines up and the cost of them. So if you have to make only a tenth of the material, obviously you can make a lot more. It's a lot cheaper. And so there should be kind of more equity associated with that as well.
Does that reduce side effects because it's spreading it out over a longer period of time?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So actually the side effects that they observed in that trial were quite similar to the mRNA vaccines. I suspect that's due to some of the manufacturing. It's obviously made in the same way. And so I think, it's kind of a side effect of that. The goal would be, like, theoretically, you should get fewer side effects with a lower dose. And that's, I know, really one of the main challenges and priorities in the field right now. But if you look at the outcomes from that clinical trial, they were actually quite similar to the mRNA vaccines.
Yeah, interesting. So it may not really have a tangible advantage over the other approach.
Yeah, not yet at least.
Yeah. Is there anything that you're aware of or that you're working on that in the pipeline that is so new, like we wouldn't have heard about it yet?
Oh, good question. So I guess a couple of things. One of the projects that we're working on now is in collaboration with some oncologists. So it's specifically an saRNA treatment for ovarian cancer, where we use the saRNA to encode a specific type of antibody called a bispecific T-cell engager. So this is, are you familiar with antibody drugs?
Yes.
Okay. So to set the scene, maybe antibodies are excellent cancer drugs, right? They're very specific. They don't have the horrific side effects that chemotherapy does, But one of the main challenges with them is that they're very expensive to develop and produce. So sometimes they're up to $10,000 a dose. And this is just obviously very limiting for these medicines. So the idea with using RNA to encode antibodies is that, you know, when we're making this and scaling it up, making the RNA in the formulations is essentially the same every time as making it for the vaccine. So that process is very well established. So for every new antibody, if you're making it as a protein, you need to optimize that whole process specifically for that drug. Whereas for the RNA, it should be very similar. It should be a straightforward scale up, you know, knock on wood, as always. So we're interested in using these new types of antibodies that are called bispecific T-cell engagers, or BiTEs. And they're a little antibody that binds to both a T-cell and a tumor cell. So they have two recognition sites. And essentially what they do is they lead a cytotoxic T-cell directly to a cancer cell and enable cancer, or enable killing of that cancer cell. So one of the, so they've been shown to work really well. One of the main challenges with them is that they are missing a part of the antibody called the FC region that allows it to circulate for a long time in the blood. So they have really low circulation half-life. So it's about 1 to 2 hours. So when patients get treated with these BiTEs, they're constantly being infused with the BiTEs for like 4 to 6 weeks in a normal treatment course. So this is obviously like a very demanding treatment schedule. Our idea is that because we get such a good expression with our saRNA, we can encode the BiTEs and then ideally give a patient an injection, and then you just get expression of the BiTEs. You have your own cells producing that antibody over the course of a month. And so it's a much easier treatment plan for that.
So would this technology potentially replace like monoclonal antibody technology?
I guess it's like kind of a different form of a monoclonal antibody. But yeah, that's kind of the idea, is that instead of having these big centralized pharmaceutical manufacturing plants to make monoclonals, we just use a patient's body to make the monoclonal instead.
Ooh.
Yeah. How far off do you think, like, you know, before we see these kind of drugs actually like approved by the FDA?
Yeah, actually, Moderna has some like large scale phase 1/2 trials, not for the specific type of antibody that we're looking at, but they actually have some incredible data from some of their antibody clinical trials. So, you know, you never know. The development is just never going to be as quick as it was during the pandemic, because obviously the whole world was working on one disease. The scientists, clinicians, regulators, everybody was focused on COVID. But I think in the next, like, you know, 3 to 5 years, we'd have outcomes from a phase 3 trial, and then, you know, they would see about getting regulatory approval for it.
Cool.
So, Anna, do you ever think farther in, like, 50 years in the future or so, and think, oh, and to try to imagine, you know, what would RNA-based vaccines, or just even other types of vaccines, what it could be like in the coming generations?
Yeah, you know, I think we're starting to see actually like some of the things that sound so futuristic come online a little bit more. But where I think medicine is really headed, and why I think RNA is a great tool and platform for this, is just really for like the modularity and the personalization, right? So some of the work that BioNTech is actually really known for, I would say was their main emphasis prior to the pandemic, was these personalized cancer vaccines, right? So you can take a biopsy of a patient's tumor, you look at what proteins are on the surface of that tumor, and then you make an RNA vaccine that specifically targets that person's cancer. I would not be surprised if, you know, in the future, with the power of sequencing, with the power of RNA technology, and kind of all these other different drugs and protein design that is really starting to come online, that we'd be able to have better healthcare because of that, because we wouldn't be doing, you know, humans are so heterogeneous, right? It's like we all have different makeup in our blood and our cells. And so it's really hard with just off the shelf drugs to be able to account for that variability. But if you're able to make drugs that are personalized for a person based off of, you know, their genetics, their biochemistry, they, you know, should be a lot more effective. And so because we have medicines like mRNA, where it's easy to manufacture them on a per person basis, I like that is the future to me, is just making these things more personalized so that we can have more efficacious medicines.
Yeah, it really seems like we're in the middle of a real revolution in terms of therapeutics, you know, leveraging antibody RNA or sort of molecular technology.
Yeah, exactly. And if, just like if you compare it to the cancer drugs, for example, of yesteryear, you know, with chemotherapy, it's a drug that, you know, many types of cancers will get the same drug because we're just killing every rapidly dividing cell in your body. So it's just so non-specific. It's kind of crazy that it even works, right? But what we're trying to do is make this like so specific so you stop seeing those off-target effects, those side effects, and just have efficacy, you know, at the cells and the tissues where you really want it and need it.
All right, Anna, well, that was a really fascinating interview. We really appreciate you giving us your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So good luck on your social media endeavors. Where can people find you?
So I'm on TikTok at Anna Blakeney, and also the same on Twitter.
Okay, yeah, and we'll link to that in the show notes as well.
Cool.
All right. Well, you take care. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have three recent news items this week, but there's a theme. The theme is negative results.
Okay.
All studies which had negative results.
Except one. Or maybe all three did.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Item number one. A study of the use of augmented reality glasses in social interactions found no significant impact. Item number two. A recent Finnish study found that the type and amount of fungus, molds, and yeast found in the home of young children do not correlate with the risk of developing asthma. And item number three, a study following children from age 10 to 16 did not find any correlation between social media use and symptoms of anxiety and depression. Bob, go first.
So let's see. This first one here, I didn't quite follow that one. Study on the use of augmented reality glasses and social interaction found no significant impact with the social interaction.
Yeah, so the somebody in a social interaction using augmented reality glasses didn't affect the social interaction at all.
Must be some damn good augmented reality. There's different ways to interpret that. But so this is augmented. This isn't virtual. So this
is augmented.
Like, so there's just like basically extra information being overlaid. Okay, that's Well, I mean, that could just be software reasons. It's just not good enough, timely enough, relevant enough information to have an impact. And said no significant impact. I mean, it probably had some, but screw all that. The one that really got me was three. This is kids 10 to 16 there was no correlation between social media use and symptoms of anxiety and depression. I would think if you're like within that age group and heavily into social media, that it would have to probably be some link to anxiety and depression, but maybe it's just like kind of like baked in, and there's it'd be more genetic than environmental. I don't know. So now I'm not as confident as I was on first blush. So let's take a look at the second one then, shall we? So fungus, molds, and yeast, no relation with asthma. I have no idea. I never heard of any link with asthma and molds and yeast. Could be, for sure. There could be some link. But then you'd think that there'd be most kids in a family would have it, since they'd be in this pretty much the same environment. All right, screw it. I'll just say that the social media one. I'll say that one's fiction, whatever. Roll the dice.
Jay.
I was thinking that too, Bob. I was agreeing with you on that. But let me go through all these.
Very wise
of you. So, yeah, you know, social media, it has been reported to, you know, affect anxiety and depression. But, you know, this could be some rando study that said they didn't find a correlation. I don't know. The second one here, a recent Finnish study that found that the type of amount of fungus found in the home of young children does not correlate with the risk of developing asthma. It's another thing that you hear about and you think that's, you know, basically something that most people would think is true, but okay, so it's possible that it doesn't have an effect. And then the first one says the study of the use of augmented reality glasses in social interactions found no significant impact. I feel really sketchy about that one. Mm. I would think that there would be a massive impact, you know?
Yeah, right?
I think that would be very game, like a game changer. So I'm going to say, I think that the first one is the fiction. I think that the augmented reality glasses actually do have a significant impact.
And Evan.
Yeah, you would think the use of glasses would have, well, I guess it's how you define significant impact. No significant impact. Maybe it had an impact, but just not a significant impact. There's some sort of difference there. But I suppose if everybody's in the augmented reality, you're able to, the augmented reality itself compensates for that impact barrier in a way, right? So it kind of cancels itself out. It's, you don't see people wearing the stuff maybe in the augmented reality, and therefore it doesn't have that impact. I don't know. The second one about the fungus and found in the home of young children, not correlating with the risk of developing asthma. I wish I knew more about specifically asthma and how it's all about. I might be wrong. It has to do with the particulates in the air that something about the lungs in the young people that they can't filter it out. Is how much of that would be fungus though? There's a lot of stuff in the air, you know. I always thought it was maybe more like an allergy, just a severe sort of allergy to pollen and those kinds of things, which are not fungus. And then the last one, Bob, I was really also thinking along the same lines with you, the 10 to 16, not finding any correlation between social media use and symptoms of anxiety. The only thing that's holding me back on saying this one's the fiction is that it's a study. So I'm sure this is being studied multiple times. I mean, maybe there is one study that didn't find it. That's the only kind of thing I can think about this one and why it might be science. They all have reasons, and therefore I will say, what the heck? I'll go with the fungus one as the fiction. That way, Steve, we're all spread out.
Yeah, all spread out. Great. I love that. All right. So let's take these in reverse order.
Ah.
Okay.
A study following children from 10 to 16 did not find any correlation between social media use and symptoms of anxiety and depression. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Devin, you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Christ, yeah. I suck.
So this was, yes, there have been studies looking at this and with, you know, varied results, but this is a very large study with a long follow-up. They followed these kids from age 10 to 16. Yeah. So, you know, it's a pretty robust study. I didn't tell you that this was a study in Norway. Would that have affected your answers?
Oh, my God, totally.
Norway.
And they didn't find any significant correlation. It's interesting. I always find it interesting when you guys make a lot out of my use of the word significant, but every study has that threshold, right? Every single study is about quote-unquote significant results. It's like,
but wait, we're significant. It's in the first one. It's in the augmented reality one.
Yeah, I know.
It's significant.
Okay, I know, but it applies. I'm just making that observation.
Oh, okay.
But you're right. Yeah, that's the first one. So what they did, they did not find any significant change in evaluations of anxiety and depression, but also they found the other way, that in kids who developed anxiety and depression didn't alter their social media use either.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it kind of went both ways. It basically, like, the two things had nothing to do with each other. Again, no one study is definitive, you know, but it was a fairly robust study, 810 subjects for 6 years. It's a pretty long follow-up, and there was just no signal there. All right, let's go back to number two. A recent Finnish study found that the type and amount of fungus, molds, and yeast found in the home of young children do not correlate with the risk of developing asthma. Evan, you think this one is a fiction. Bob and Jay think this one is science. And this one is science. It's my science as well. So well, yeah, this
Jay.
Is this, yeah. So Jay won this week. So this has been a long term controversy. Like, how much of an effect does household mold and yeast have on respiratory symptoms? Now, obviously, when levels get high enough, obviously, you know, that can have an impact. But this was just looking at the range of mold and yeast found in Finnish homes. They tried to see if they could correlate either the amount or the species, right? Like, are there some species of fungi that are more likely to be associated with the later development of asthma? Or is there some threshold of exposure? And what they found was basically they couldn't conclude that there was any relationship. There was no robust signal there either. So it was basically negative. I could read the results. The results of our analysis from this well-characterized birth cohort suggest that the early life house dust mycobiota. Ever heard that term, Bob? Mycobiota?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. Characterized by a DNA amplicon sequencing, do not have strong predisposing or protective effects on asthma development. So yeah, they looked at it both ways. It was neither protecting or predisposing. Okay, this means that a study of the use of augmented reality glasses in social interactions found no significant impact. Is the fiction mainly because there wasn't actually a study?
Wow.
It was more of an analysis, like a model. They didn't do an actual study.
It's only a model.
And what they concluded was that there was the potential for significant interactions, and specifically the person with the augmented reality glasses, that the AR glasses create an information asymmetry that would disrupt the power balance and the equilibrium between the two individuals. So that the person who had the ability to get information on the other person, for example, would give them, especially if they're doing it on the sly, that would create a power imbalance in the interaction. That was their conclusion. But it wasn't like a study of this is actually happening. It was more of just like an evaluation of the potential for this to happen. But that's why it's a fiction, because there wasn't a study that showed no interaction. And that, so well, it'll be interesting, you know, if like advanced augmented reality becomes a thing, and like every time you're interacting with somebody who's wearing glasses or maybe even contact lenses at some point, you have to wonder like what information do they have access to. Mm-hmm. And it might get to the point where you just have to assume that everybody has it, you know?
Yeah, right.
And there'll probably be, at least for a time, like you'll be able to tell when somebody's like accessing their augmented reality information, unless they're like tinted glasses. So you can't see their eyes.
Like a dungeon crawler, Carl, Steve, you could see the glow in their eyes.
Yeah. So it may become like, you have to, what will be the impact on social interactions? Like what will become the social norm adaptation to this? Like, will it be rude to be wearing, like to be hiding your eyes from somebody who is, like it may become socially unacceptable. Like, I'm not going to talk to somebody wearing glasses where I can't see their eyes because I have no idea what they're doing. You know,
It's impossible to predict, but lots of possibilities.
All right. Well, good job, Jay.
Nice, Jay.
Thank you.
Well done, Jay.
Just so you guys know, I read that.
Oh, did you?
Nice.
Oh.
I was actually going to ask you if I could do that as a news item for the.
Okay.
Well, there you go.
Major you'd never admit that, dude. Come
guess
on.
Not.
No, that Steve will edit that out.
Or not.
That's fine. Not necessarily.
It's not cheating to read science news, guys.
Of course not. Of course not. But it diminishes your achievement, it seems.
I don't know. It's a different kind of achievement. It's being knowledgeable about recent science news.
Yes, I hear you. But it diminishes it.
Steve did not edit Perry in episode one when he told him to get closer to his microphone. Just remind you that I know we're going back a ways.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
The quote this week was suggested by a listener, Jan, from Rochester, New York. Thank you, Jan. Not bound by facts, the hoax is free to fabricate feelings and the genres associated with them. It is this artfulness and ambiguity that help explain its popularity.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Young, from his book called Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Mm-hmm. 2017 book.
Yeah, nice. We have expressed that exact same thought, you know, not in those words. The idea that pseudoscience, that whatever, is unencumbered by facts and reality, right? And when you're unencumbered by reality, then you can tweak your narrative to be psychologically appealing.
Of course.
Right? That's the only thing that matters then is how well you could sell it. It's not limited by actual facts or reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's like, agree with that.
It's fiction. Becomes a total fiction. Yep. Right. But you're free to do whatever you want. Let your imagination run wild.
It's asymmetrical warfare, you know.
I know.
It's an unfortunate advantage.
I know.
You know.
Yep.
I think there are different advantages that being actually true have, but the advantage of being unmoored from reality is that you could have the best narrative. You know, you could tell people what they want to hear.
I'd still rather be true unless I want to make money.
Yeah.
There's that too.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's the point, I think. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it. Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.